discussed this question. We did not give proofs in detail, but at this point I will suppose that we have this local existence theorem, and I want to discuss today both the global existence, so under which condition this solution that exists during a finite time can be extended to all time. And I would like also to discuss the global regularity in for small, so I will discuss that, I will explain initial conditions. Alright, and if we are lucky we can start the next chapter about solutions that do not exist globally, that indeed blow up in a finite time. Okay, so local existence, I don't come back to it, but maybe I will remind you what we proved, or at least where we are. So here we have the nonlinear Schrödinger equation. So in its general form, we put, did I put S or sigma last time? Sigma? We consider the problem in the whole space. It is an initial value problem. Okay. And the first result, I mean the main result that we have stated was that if I take the nonlinearity not too large, this is in dimension larger than 2, or and no condition on sigma if n equals 1 or 2, then there exists a unique solution to the nonlinear Schrödinger equation. This solution is a continuous function of time, and we have seen that we can take time negative or positive. We can integrate Schrödinger equation in both directions with value in H1. There is a unique solution. So this solution is maximal in the sense there are two possibilities. Or T is infinite and you have a global solution. So either or T is finite, and as T approaches, as time approaches this particular time, the H1 norm approaches infinity. And in addition, this solution, so doing for T smaller than T, so between minus T and T, we have the conservation laws that the L2 norm of the solution is conserved . Often we call it N. So the L2 norm of the solution is conserved, and the energy of the solution is also conserved. So it's a minus. Lambda over sigma plus 1. So this quantity is called energy or Hamiltonian So as we said last time, this theorem requires some functional analysis, not absolutely evident, although it's considered as a classical result. Yes, Andre? It is not absolutely evident that it is equal, but you can prove that they are equal. It's not absolutely evident, you're right. Well, in general, we'll consider only t positive, but, you know, if you state it in the general case, and, you know, in the book of Kaznav that you borrowed from me, he takes some time to prove that indeed he has, you know, T1 here and T2, and he takes some time to prove that T1 equals minus. He has, you know, T star like this, and he takes some time to prove that these two times are the same. Sorry? If you
suppose we have initial condition,
yes,
let's solve this. Suppose a condition is from minus 2 to 2. If I introduce this type, which is shifted by 1, the new solution will be from minus 3 to 1.
Well, let's discuss that a little bit later. Well, to do that, you know, you need an estimate on the time, and this time depends on the initial condition. This time of existence is not arbitrary; it depends on the initial condition. So, I don't know if it's not that you can extend your time. You know, you have an existence theorem from 0 to t. And this t depends on the norm, let's say the H1 norm of the initial condition. It is not that always that you can start from here and extend it arbitrarily. You can go forward a little bit, probably not further than this, because it's a maximal solution. Probably not, because Well, you know, these time of existence are like essentially it's a quadrat. It's, let's see, if it's cubic, it's like this. So, well, I know that we can discuss it. There's a proof that that is not completely trivial to show that it is equal. So we can discuss it from the book next time or later after the class. Okay, so what about global existence? So we have two cases. Case one and the two cases will refer to the sign of lambda, whether lambda is negative or positive. So case one is lambda equals minus one. And we have seen that lambda equals plus or minus one. By scaling, you can always take it by plus or minus one. So if lambda equals minus one, it is called the defocusing NLS. And then the theorem says that this solution, the local above solution, can be extended for all time. So under the same condition on the nonlinearity, so it means that C is a continuous function of T from minus infinity to infinity. Solution exists globally. And what is the reason for it? The reason is that we're going to use the conservation, the proof as long as the solution exists, right, for as long as T is between T, psi satisfies the conservation law, gradient C. So lambda is minus one, so it's plus, right? Constant. So as long as the solution exists, we have a uniform bound for each of these two terms. So in particular, it's a uniform in T. For gradient psi L2, right? And since we have also a uniform bound for the L2 norm, it means a uniform bound in T for the H1 norm So this is a situation where this occurs in many nonlinear PDEs, and it's a systematic procedure to prove that the solution exists for all time. Let me start from zero. I don't care about the negative. If you want to show that the solution exists for all time, you prove first that the solution exists during a finite time. This is the first part. And then you show that during this finite time, during this time that the solution exists, its norm is uniformly bounded in T. Which means that you can start from a little bit, even easier, from the fact that the solution is maximal. This implies automatically that T is infinite because the solution is maximal solution. Alright. Well, now the way to say it was the thing that I was just starting to do is to say, well, if I start a little bit before T, since I have the same estimate for this, for the H1 norm here and here, I can essentially increase the sum of existence for the same amount, and I can repeat this argument. So this is very important because this is defocusing. And defocusing means that the energy is the sum of two positive terms, is the sum of two terms, each of them is bounded. Now, what happened in the second case? In the non-focus, in the focusing case. Is lambda equal plus 1. Now lambda equal plus 1, this local solution satisfies the energy, but so the local solution satisfies conservation of energy. But now this energy is a difference of two norms. So although the difference is conserved, a priori you could not exclude that one of them, that both of them becomes infinite. And this is indeed the case sometimes. So this argument doesn't work anymore. And the theorem can be stated in this form, theorem. So again, we have phi in H1, and now we have to assume that the nonlinearity satisfies sigma if the nonlinearity satisfies sigma smaller or equal to 2 over n. Well, you see that it is more restrictive than sigma smaller than 2 over n minus 2. In particular, in dimension 2, you had no condition, while here in dimension 2, you must take sigma strictly smaller than 1. Then, the local solution, then solution exists for all time. In other words, given a dimension, this local solution exists for all time only if the nonlinearity is not too large. If it is too large, if it is larger than this, we will have two cases. One case for general H1, you might have singularities. And the other case, if you can still have existence for all time if this initial condition is small enough. So this is what we'll discuss. So let me first finish with this, prove this theorem here. So this is theorem 1, theorem 2. Well, it comes, we have to use proof. We're going to use the conservation of energy that we're going to write. So you see, we want to see that this H1 norm can be bounded for all time. So we're going to try to bound this term. So use energy, which means that the gradient of C, well, as long as solution exists, as long as the solution exists, that is for t smaller than t, we have that this is smaller than h, so h. At this point, I don't know if h of c is positive or negative, it doesn't matter, I put absolute value, plus 1 over sigma, the L 2 sigma plus 2 norm of the solution. Can you help me with this one, Andrew? Oh, no, the other one. Okay. And here we use Gallardo-Nuremberg. Inequality that we used already last time. So I'm going to write it here. Gallardo-Nuremberg says that if I take the L2 sigma plus 2 norm, which is exactly this one, right? I have to, if I want an estimate for this, I have to estimate the right hand side, this one. So I can bound this integral in terms of a certain constant that depends only on the dimension and on sigma and the dimension, multiplied by gradient f sigma n, this I put L2, and FL2. So if you take the Gallardo-Nuremberg that I wrote in the most general form last time, and you decide to have, you know, on the left-hand side no derivative, on the right-hand side one derivative, you adjust your parameters that we had to it on the general form. You also want to have L2 here, L2 there. This imposes your coefficients. Okay, so this is the Gallardo-Nuremberg in this particular case. And now we're going to apply it to that formula. So, in particular, so apply this to the last formula. So what do I get? Well, as long as I can manipulate these solutions, which is as long as the solution exists, this is bounded by, well, H I don't touch, 1 over sigma plus 1. And now, this C2 sigma plus 2, I'm going to bound it by this. So sigma C, so this is a constant. N sigma, this is a constant. Right. Gradient C, well, the same one. Well, what power? Sigma N. Now you see why sigma N. And Cl2, I know what it is. It is conserved. It's N. I just have to write N, the initial L2 norm, to the power 2 plus sigma 2 minus. All right, so N capital is the L2 initial L2 norm of the initial condition. So what do I have? Let me just for simplicity call x of t is this L2 norm that I'm interested to estimate. Right? And all this is a constant, Cn sigma over sigma plus 1 multiplied by n. So let me call capital K of phi. It's a number that you construct from this constant, this Sobolev constant, this Gallardo-Nuremberg constant, sigma over 1, and the L2 norm of the initial condition, right? Let me go back to this so you remember. It's the same thing. And what do we have? Well, we have x of t. This estimate tells me that x of t is small or equal to, well, h, this is a number, k of phi is also a number, x to the power sigma n over 2. Okay. Well, what can you say from this? So x of t is a function of t, and it satisfies this estimate. What can you say? Yes, it remains, x of t remains bounded always if sigma n divided by 2 is smaller than 1. Forget about the dependence in t. If we have a certain, well, you have to remember the dependency. But what, you know, if sigma n over 2 is smaller than 1, x of t cannot go to infinity. Indeed, well, if you take sigma n over 2 smaller than 1, x of t cannot go to infinity, because if it would go to infinity, it was unbounded. Here the power is smaller, so this would go to infinity faster than this one. This is not possible. So if sigma over 2 is n, x of t is uniformly bounded independent. This bound is in m is independent of t. There is no t here. This is a constant, this is a constant. Well, and you know, another way to see it that is sometimes useful, consider the function, consider a function f of x, little x, not this, nothing to, f of theta, to be theta minus h minus k of phi. This is also a number. Theta alpha, right? With alpha equals sigma n over 2 smaller than 1. And you draw this picture, you draw the picture of the function f as a function of theta. So when theta equals 0, you know what, I'm going to take the opposite. Right? Take the opposite. So when theta is 0, it's h. And when theta is going to infinity, it's minus x, right? So I don't know exactly how it is, but it's certainly like that. So it tells you that f remains positive only if theta is in some interval. Since this estimate is true as long as the solution exists, it means that my x of t must satisfy that this, that f of x of t remains positive, in this notation. So if f must remain positive, it says that theta must be remain in the bounded domain. So just the same thing in the geometric picture. All right? However, if sigma n is over 2 is larger or equal to 1, well, you can say nothing. Yes. Yes. So it is equal to 1, we discuss that in a minute. It is, if it is equal to 1, then it will be true if the constants are small enough. Yeah. So we'll do that in a minute. Okay. Okay, so everybody is comfortable with this analysis? So we prove this theorem, which is true only. So for example, think already in dimension 2, you don't get the cubic NLS. In fact, cubic NLS in dimension 2 does blow up in a finite time when this is not satisfied. Okay. Okay, so let's go on and see what we can say. So here we just have a uniform bound. Well, maybe I should continue here. We have a uniform bound for all t, independent of t, and thus by the local existence theorem that is, gives you a maximal solution, then solution exists or can be extended for all time. All right. Well, let's now discuss theorem 3. Indeed, the case where you would like to get a little bit further than this condition, and the price you will pay is to impose condition on your initial condition. So I will. Yes, let me give it to you just in H1. It's simpler. So suppose that sigma is indeed between 2 over n, so it's larger. We are in the next, in when this is not satisfied. So the, and on this side, well, by the existence theorem, we cannot go further than 2 over n minus 2. Otherwise, no condition in n for n equals 2, for 1. Okay? So again, take phi in H1, initial condition in H1, and suppose that gradient phi in L2 small enough, and we'll explain, we will find exactly what this means. Small enough. We will when we do the proof, we will see what is the condition to ensure on this initial condition to have the proof work. Then the solution exists for all time in H1. So this theorem says that, well, if your nonlinearity does not satisfy this condition, the sufficient condition to get global existence is to take an initial condition that is small enough in H1. And okay, so how do we do that? Will you do this? It's the same estimate that we're going to use. I can still write this. X of t. But now this parameter alpha, which is sigma n over 2, is larger than 1. Or equal to 1. Is larger or equal to 1. Well, it is the same story. You're going to say that let's draw the picture of f of theta minus theta plus h plus k of phi theta to the power alpha. But now alpha is larger than 1. So if you draw the picture, when since alpha is, so you start here, right? You start here. This is h, so I'm drawing f of theta. You start h. Now, what is the derivative when h at theta equals 0? This will be 1 minus 1. The derivative is minus 1. Since alpha is larger than 1, so suppose k of phi, well, you know what I should have said, h1. I think you need to both of them. Small enough. Now, for example, smaller than 1, well, it will go like this. What is it? Right? I did this because, you know, if alpha is strictly larger than 1, the derivative is minus 1, because this gives 0. But if alpha equals 1, you have minus 1 plus k. So if I want a derivative that go down, I will have to suppose k is small. Okay? Yeah. Okay. And then you know that it goes when theta is large, it goes like this. Right? So you have two situations. It might do this, right? Or it might do that. Maybe I should have two colors. It might do this. Or it might not touch. Now, what is the difference between these two pictures? It is the constant, the value of the constant. Why? Let me do it again. If h is small enough, well, necessarily you will have to go down and up. If h is large enough, you might very well go like this. So the condition is if let me discuss again this. So suppose that you are in the blue situation for a minute. Suppose that you're in the blue situation, so you were able to cross the x-axis. Now, what you want from this is to get an x bounded for all time. So you want so a situation where theta corresponds to a positive f. You want to remain either here or here. But now, to remain here, now if you are here, theta is very large. This is not the situation. This is the situation you want to avoid. So you want to be in a situation where your x remain in this interval. So initially, it must be in this interval. So you have two conditions. First, to ensure that the blue curve indeed occurs, that this function f crosses the x axis. And second, you have to take an initial condition small enough so that its position is, for example, here. Then, because f of theta must remain positive, theta must be is bounded. Okay, so this is a very this is an argument that you will see many times when you have an estimate of this type. So there are two conditions. The first condition is that the function, the curve of theta, of f of theta, crosses the x-axis. And the second condition is that the initial condition, x of 0, is smaller than the first 0 of f of theta. And the condition 2 so the condition to have 1 is I wonder if it is enough. Well, one way to see it is that you calculate the derivative of f, which is minus 1 plus alpha k of phi theta alpha minus 1. So you calculate the derivative, and you want that the zero of the derivative, right? The zero of the derivative corresponds to... So then you call theta 0 the point such that f prime of theta 0 is 0, and you impose that f of theta 0 is negative. This is the condition. So you can just calculate theta 0, plug it out, and this gives the condition... h small enough and k of phi small enough. Okay. And h small enough, h is the difference of two things, but it's enough to take each of them small, which in fact this corresponds, this is a very brutal bound, but this corresponds to essentially phi h1 small. And this is phi l2 small. Okay? Yes, yes. Eaton. Phi L2 small enough to ensure that.
This constant doesn't depend on phi.
No, it doesn't depend on phi. So, yes, you have to take into account when you write the bound. But this analysis shows that if you take essentially phi h1 small enough, you have done the job, because it will ensure that the first that it will ensure both things. Well, you have to take it as small as necessary to ensure the two things. Is it okay? All right. So this is a crude theorem, but we're going to improve it in a minute it is a cool theorem, but you you can state it in a more general form. So an extension of this theorem, of the last theorem, to a solution in HS is not necessarily one. So I'm not going to prove it, but it is essentially in the same spirit. If you take sigma between 2 over n and 2 over n minus 2, so you remember we are in the defocusing, in the focusing case, eh? We are in the focusing case, and you take C in HS with condition on S that S is larger . You don't need to do this in H1, you can do it in HS. Then, such that the HS norm small enough then global existence in H set. So we'll not prove that theorem. It needs an estimate of this type, but at a higher order derivative. All right. But now we're going to improve these very rough conditions in the special case sigma equals 2 over n. So I'm going to move that away. So you see, that was a little bit rough as condition on CH1, and I'm going now to concentrate for the next theorem to the case of still focusing non-linearity and sigma n, the limit case, sigma n equals 2, and this case was studied in particular because of its interest when you have sigma equals 1, n equals 2. It's the usual cubic NLS in 2D, the one that people in optics use all the time. So. Okay. Which means that if you're in dimension 1, it is a quartic non-linear Schrödinger equation. Right? If you look at the equation up there, sigma equals 1 is cubic NLS, the 2D cubic NLS. Sigma equals 2, n equals 1, sigma equals 2 is a quartic potential. All right. So, the theorem says that we take phi in H1, and as I repeat, sigma n equals 2 exactly. Then suppose in addition that the L2 norm of the initial condition is smaller or equal to, oh, I have not written the condition. Yes, I have. One over sigma plus one, and this to the power, it's not very important, but so this is a number, So you see, in this theorem, I suppose only that the L2 norm is small. I do not suppose that H1 is small. Then the solution exists. The solution exists for all time in H1. Okay, so this is a refinement of the previous theorem. In the special case where sigma n equals 2, I do not need any condition on the gradient of the L2 norm. I impose only a condition on the L2 norm of the solution. Sigma plus 1 should be, thank you. Yeah, correct. And next remark that I will, the best constant, well, this is a, you see, this is the way I state it, is it's a sufficient condition. If I take phi L2 smaller than this particular number, then global regularity will occur. The next statement is that we can calculate the best constant, and the best constant is sharp. So the best constant can be calculated. So what does that mean to calculate the best constant? It means to find the exact Sobolev phi n. So if I'm able to calculate the best phi sigma n, the best constant that I use in the Sobolev inequality, in the Gagliardoni-Rundberg inequality, and then I will have the sharp estimate, and later by a specific example I will show that it is sharp. So the best constant can be calculated in terms of the function R. So what is R? R is the unique positive solution of a nonlinear elliptic equation. So at some point I will have to explain a little bit more, but do you remember that when we did we discuss that function at some point? I think in one dimension at least we calculated the exact solution. So let R, we haven't proved it, but R is a unique positive solution of this nonlinear PDE. It is a radially it is a solution like this, if I may say it like that. It is positive, it decreases exponentially at infinity. It is radially symmetric. And it's called ground state. So we will not discuss that in detail, but this best constant is phi L2 . So let me repeat. If we are in the special case sigma n equals 2 with initial condition in H1, if the L2 norm is strictly smaller than the L2 norm of that particular function that is called the ground state and is of importance in the theory of nonlinear Schrödinger equation, then the solution exists for all time. So let me move that. Okay, the proof. Well, at least the first part of the proof is easy. We are still with the the bound coming from the conservation of the energy and the Galliardo-Nirenberg inequality. So x of t small or equal to h plus this constant now. What is the power here? Sigma n equals 2, so it's just 2 sigma. And sigma n equals 2, so this is just right. You agree with me? Well, that becomes now it's elementary. X of t, 1 minus sigma n sigma right. So if you want to have x of an uniform bound for x of t, this parenthesis must be chosen to be strictly smaller than 1. Well, this gives the condition on the initial condition, the L2 norm of the initial condition. Right. We don't need to make any assumption on the initial value of the H1 norm. This is the way. Well, this result was obtained by Michael Weinstein, 83. It's quite amazing because it was his PhD thesis result in 83, and we still quote his result. You know, 20 years later, it's quite nice. And his approach was indeed to go back to the Galliardo-Nirenberg inequality and minimize the functional his purpose was to minimize the functional g of, you know, f, exactly the ratio. With the right powers. So sigma n equals 2, so this is 2, and this is exactly f. What was there? 2 sigma. And his approach was indeed to minimize this functional so by variational methods that are now well used. He proved that first of all, this functional has a minimum, and the minimum is exactly the solution of this equation up to constant that you can eliminate by scaling. And so this is indeed the Euler-Lagrange equation corresponding to this minimization problem. So I will not do it today this time because maybe we want to talk about blow-up. But it is...
How would you this can be considered as quasi or second order ordinary differential equation for the R. But how would you characterize, it has many solutions, how would you characterize which one?
So there has been a lot of work on this equation. So the first thing is to prove that all solutions are radially symmetric. This is one thing. And then you classify the solutions by their number of zeros. So there is a sequence of solutions, if you want R0, R1, R2, Rn. R0 is the first one in my. It's the one that minimizes the functional. The rest are extremum of the functional, are not minimum, and they have 1 0, 2 zeros, 3 zeros, etc. They all exponential. They are all radial, and there's only one that is strictly positive.
This.
The this one, this solution, this, the solution of which that I'm talking about has a very specific.
It has to be
flat, of course, but it has a value, a very special value at R equals zero. You know, if you want to do numerical simulation, and you integrate that, you must somehow choose the initial condition. If you don't choose the exact corresponding to this one, you will end up having an oscillatory one. So by shooting methods, people have calculated that. So let me still give you explain to you why it is the best constant by writing down a solution of the NLS equation. So I'm going to write down the solution of NLS equation, which is, so I'm considering sigma n equals 2, right? Sigma n equals 2. So here I can, if I want, I can put 4 over n, just to remember that we are in a specific case. And I'm going to write down a solution whose L2 norm is exactly the L2 norm of this ground state, and that blows up. So that is not, that does not exist for all time. So let me write it down here. C of x of t equals 1 over to write the correct phase is, so first of all it's R, so this is a self-similar solution, so it has the form of this function R, and I'm going to write the phase term, and the phase is like this, I x squared well, there are several ways to, so let me first comment about this formula. If you calculate the L2 norm of this function C, well, let's do it together. Just, what do you get? N, the integral over R of X over T star minus T dx squared, right? And now, of course, I'm going to do the change of variable. I divide by t star minus t each of these x1, x2, xn. So I multiply and divide by t star minus 2 to the power. And I get if I call C X over T star minus T, I get that integral of C of T, T of X and T dx. Well, it's exactly R of C dxi, right? This is dxi, and this one cancels out with that one. So this particular solution has L2 norm R, has exactly the L2 norm of this ground state. And by its form, you see that as T approaches this particular number T star, it grows up in a, it becomes infinite. Right. Now, if you remember, how should I explain where does this solution come from? Well, if you remember one of the problem sets we did a while ago, or even if you remember, so how shall I say that? There are two things. The first thing, if I consider this equation here, I have a particular solution that can I can write in the form EIT R of X, where R is indeed the solution of well, it is not difficult to see that you plug it back, you plug this solution into the NLS equation, and you realize that the equation that R must satisfy is this one. And this is true, it doesn't matter whether you are in this critical case sigma n equals 2 or not. Now the second thing is that you, in this particular case sigma n is equal to, we have the pseudo-conformal invariance. Which tells you that if you have a solution, you can construct another one by making some transformation on x, t, and the function itself. And if you go back to your notes of that time when we discussed this invariance and scaling properties, in this special case sigma n is equal to, we wrote a particular invariance that is called the pseudo-conformal invariance. If you apply it, this pseudo-conformal invariance to this particular solution, you end up with that one. Now, what else? In the very specific case of the one-dimensional problem, in the special case n equals 1, then the equation becomes r double prime minus r plus r 2 sigma plus 1 equals 0. And I think it was one of the problem set we found to find to find the solution. In fact, in this one-dimensional case, there is a unique solution. And one calculates it. One can calculate it. Now, I can't write it by memory, but it was in the form of a hyperbolic cosine at a certain power. And it's in my other book, so I don't have it here. But it was given in this assignment to recover this solution. So at least in one dimension, you can write what is R. And so here is a singular solution. So I had in mind to write another regularity result for small initial condition. It is in my notes, so whoever wants to have it or take it to the web when it comes on the web, you can do that. I want to skip it to be able to start tomorrow the next chapter on blow-up properties. So another result on global existence for small initial condition. You can access it if you like. Oh, you know, to be able to use this pseudo-conformal invariance, this pseudo-conformal invariance tells you that if I have a solution, I have another solution that I can write down. So this one, I'm taking as this original solution, IT R of X. Yes, because this is a calculation. Because if you take EITR, you plug it in here, so EIT doesn't appear, so 2 sigma, you plug it into the NLS equation, here you get, and R does not depend on T, R is a function of X only, so this gives you exactly I, thank you. This gives you exactly minus R. Exponential IT is everywhere, you compensate. Yeah? So looking for, but of course to prove existence of solution of this problem, it's a, you know, complicated nonlinear elliptic equation. It is well understood now, but it requires some work to prove existence first of a unique positive solution and then a sequence of other solutions. Alright. So what I would like to start tomorrow is the chapter on blow-up solutions and a little bit of course, the existence of blowing up solutions. We already have one here, but in a more general situation. And then some element about the structure of the blow-up. For those who arrived, I would like to have this assignment, at least to look at it. It's related to the Stricart inequality. Did you get one? And did you get one?
Okay.
Tomorrow after lunch, yes? I think it's okay.
Photocopy for this balance. You said there is something with access to the website, or could you make it photocopy, or we have how to get this one?
If you want to make a copy, I can do it.
Yeah,
it is
for all class or for individual only. We make copy because I need actually more information.
Yes.
The one that you are going to skip it tomorrow.
Tomorrow I'm going to skip that thing and go.
Could make it copy.
Yes, not a problem. You know what? I have one here. Take this one. Yeah, well, I think she made. Is it? Did she do it to the end or not? Do I have it? Local existence. 4, 5. No, this is the past. Let me see. Wait a minute. What do you want?
I want the one that we said you're going to take it tomorrow. I don't need.
Okay, I have it here.
Do I have it? This one, because you start chapter 8.
Yeah, I'm going to skip 3.
Yeah, so that one.
Yeah.
Global regularity for small initial condition.
Yeah, it is here. Do you want to take that?
Yes. And make copies? Or
no, you can take it. You can keep it. Part 2 is today, yes, it's
okay.
Finished.
And the local existence, that last week, we didn't also.
Wait a minute. Oh, this is the old book. This is chapter 7. You don't need chapter 7.
Chapter 7, that's okay, I have it.
Sorry, just one minute. Leave that on the side. Chapter 7. So, chapter 7, you don't need smoothing effect, local existence. You want this part?
I want the local existence.
Also, take that,
Ali.
So, take all that.
It's all total chapter 8.
So, let me see, compare with the notes. Oh, you can always photocopy from here, but if I have it already, it's no point. Yes, it's total chapter 8. Yes? You want to talk to me, Andre? Yes?
Yeah,
right.
Then you should talk about this.
It is the same, in a sense, because, you know, because this, you are right, but this, you bound it by, you mean the initial condition, right? Or physics.
Yes.
You bound it in terms of, by Gagliardoni-Renberg, in terms of gradient phi, L2, and phi L2. So to say that this is small means that both of them are small. Or you want to... You see? So since it is brutal, I mean, it's not very precise. It is rough estimates. Well, the fact that I write that H1 must be small. But you are right, that's fine. You can say that this must be small, but to say that this is small is the same as saying that this is small.
Okay.
Oh, the H1 now is small. Equality. No. In the dimension, but any dimension, but sigma n equals 2. So, dimension 2, sigma equals 1,
yeah,
dimension
yeah,
1.
I mean, sigma equals 2 over
n. Yeah. For this one.
Yeah. I have a question. So, actually, result, what's the name of this guy?
Weinstein.
So, actually,
If you take best constant for
and plug in estimate, you get best constant for.
Yes, well, what you have to do.
This is not the same.
What you have to do, when you do the best estimate, well, essentially you write the Euler-Lagrange associated to this functional. And you have some constants, you know, sigma plus one here, sigma plus one there, two sigma there. And, you know, in an equation like this, when an equation like this, you can always change x and change r, rescale r and rescale x to avoid to get rid of this. So in fact, you know, in my book we put the constant correctly, I hope.
So is it possible to write formula?
Yeah. Yeah, you differentiate, take the derivative, so essentially replace this by epsilon delta f, and this by epsilon delta f, and do the Euler-Lagrange equation formally, you will fall on the R equation. I can show you in the book, it is done.
Uh-huh.
Let me show you.
That's, and yeah, that's, because